Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Whale, CEO. In the coming years, advances in fields such as robotics, cybersecurity, genomics, all have the potential to reshape the economic landscape worldwide. This week's episode focuses on technologies and innovations that are changing our lives. In this hour, we'll hear from Alec Ross. He's Distinguished Visiting Fellow at Johns Hopkins University, and he'll be in conversation with Brad Stone of Bloomberg Businessweek. This event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Brad Stone.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. I'm Brad Stone, and it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Alec Ross is a Distinguished Visiting Fellow at Johns Hopkins University and the author of The Industries of the Future. He recently served for 4 years as Senior Advisor for Innovation to then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He has also served as the convener for the Technology, Media, and Telecommunications Policy Committee on Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign and on the Obama-Biden presidential transition team. For a conversation about the technological advances that are reshaping the global economy, please join me in welcoming Alec Ross. So, Alec, part of the joy of reading your book is seeing a really well-informed vision for what our future is going to look like. So why don't you start off by telling us, in 20 years, what kind of world are we all going to be living in?
Well, in 20 years, I think that we will all be living longer lives. I think that there will be more abundance. I think that we will have access to more information, different kinds of entertainment. We will have more and better food. We will have more stuff, so to speak, which is in and of itself not necessarily the world's greatest thing, but it is the world that I imagine for us in 20 years. I also think that in 20 years, one thing that may sound like science fiction, but I think absolutely will be the reality of the 2030s. I think that the robots of the cartoons and movies of the 1970s will be the reality 20 years from now, and that in settings like this one, there may very well be robots sitting among us, or maybe we'd make them stand against the wall. And so I think that the trends that we've experienced over the last 20 years related to digitization, where so much of our world is being converted into zeros and ones, and we're being sort of noiselessly nudged this way and that way by algorithms, I think will only continue apace. But then I think that it'll enter entirely new fields like agriculture, the life sciences, and other such things. So I think that as much change as we've experienced over the last 20 years, I think that we will see only more over the next 20.
Well, let's talk more about robots. I have a Roomba. It does a fairly okay job of cleaning the floor. I use AI tools like Siri on my iPhone. It's okay. It has always felt to me in covering technology that the promise of AI and robotics has always been high, but when you move these technologies into the messy, real, unpredictable world, the promise never quite matches up to the hype. So what kind of breakthroughs are we on the verge of that, lead to a real age of robotics?
So first of all, I completely agree with you, and our Roomba broke. There are two things that have happened, which I think are going to basically create sort of a hockey stick slope in terms of the advancement of robotics. The first is this thing called mapping belief space. So there are things that historically have been very difficult for robots, like grasping. Grasping might seem fairly straightforward, but it's actually very complex to model mathematically and to program algorithmically. And so there have been developments in mapping belief space, which are essentially taking robots from being two-dimensional devices to three-dimensional devices. The second big development is in cloud robotics. So let's talk about C-3PO for a second. If C-3PO walked into this room and sort of barged in as we're taping, he might say, "Oh, excuse me," and, go excuse himself and find an open seat. In the movie version of C-3PO, that would require like millions of dollars of hardware and software spinning in that gold gleaming body from the recognition and cognition that it takes walking into a room to recognize that he has interrupted something, to the ability to speak and know to speak in English, to then the mobility to go sit down. That's why we don't have C-3PO among us now. The C-3PO of 10 years from now, though, will be a cloud-connected device. So rather than having to have millions and millions and millions of dollars of hardware and software inside him, what he would do is he would ping the cloud and get instructions from the cloud that would say, you've interrupted them, excuse yourself in English, and go find a place to sit. So what this means is that the idea of robotics as something that can be both complex and affordable is now realistic because of the development of cloud technology, because we don't have to pack millions of dollars worth of hardware and software into every gold gleaming unit.
So obviously, when we talk about robotics, we often talk about jobs. Mm-hmm. And the provocative idea in your book is that this is really not only a threat to blue-collar jobs, but maybe ultimately a threat to white-collar jobs. Talk a little bit about that. What kind of cost will there be to the onset of these kinds of robots?
So this is something where, you know, I think that there's ample cause for concern. Look, I grew up in West Virginia, put myself through college in part by working on a beer truck and as a midnight janitor. There isn't an ounce of blue blood in this body. And, you know, went from that after college to teaching in West Baltimore, a very poor urban community. And so the communities that I grew up in and that I taught in were a rural community and an urban community that had sort of been smashed during the last wave of globalization and automation. The reasonable concern that I have now is that given the advancements that I just described in terms of mapping belief space and cloud robotics, robots will be able to do that which is has historically just been manual and routine, and increasingly we'll be able to do things that are cognitive and non-routine. So I think about my father, for example, and I love my father, but what he did for a living for 40-some-odd years is he was a country lawyer in Hurricane, West Virginia, and what he did is he basically created that 9-inch-high stack of papers that you would sign 40 times at a house closing, and your closing costs were thousands of dollars, and it took a couple months, and, you know, has not been disrupted by the digital age. In the future, that kind of labor, which is white collar but sort of low level white collar, that kind of low level white collar labor will be replaced. So it's not going to be just the work of men with big, strong shoulders working in factories that are going to lose jobs to automation and robotics. It's increasingly going to be labor that has cognition that is non-routine in nature.
So I think everyone here is wondering, are the journalists going to be okay?
Well, I actually have heard that you would know more about this than me, but aren't there like headline writing programs that are algorithmic?
We like to think we're a little bit better.
Like to think that you're a little bit better than that. I will make one point about journalism and digitization, though, which is with everybody tweeting and Facebook posting and 702,000 blogs of this and that and everything else, I actually think that now, more so than ever, great journalism is more valued and more important than ever. Like, I've become a consumer of really good long-form journalism to a degree to which I wasn't a decade or two ago, in part because with all of the tweets and the posts and the thises and the thats, I actually think that it's all the more important a time now for there to be serious, long-form, investigative, and entirely human journalism.
I paid Alec to say that. That's very nice to hear. But tell us what other maybe surprising occupations do you expect to be disrupted?
Yeah, so I think that, for example, let's think about the anesthesiologist. You know, the anesthesiologist right now, it's one of the most expensive parts of surgery. You know, when you go under, there's an anesthesiologist there. And that is because she is making sure that you survive going under during a surgical procedure. One of the things that I saw a lot was an increasing number of robotic surgeries. Over 1 million Americans have already had surgeries where a robot was involved in the surgery. And in this case, what happens is the robots don't entirely replace the humans, but the humans monitor the robots. And so the way it works is instead of there being an anesthesiologist in every surgery, there will be, say, one anesthesiologist monitoring four surgeries that are taking place simultaneously where there's robotic anesthesia. So there, it's not like there's no human oversight, but the anesthesiologist is not sitting at your bedside table. He's in a room looking at four different monitors. And that is, there's no higher form of white-collar labor than your anesthesiologist.
So how much displacement will happen? I mean, so Mark Andreessen, a venture capitalist that you cite pretty frequently in the book, would argue that to just think robots will replace people is a form of Luddite thinking, mm-hmm. and that human needs always expand, and that there will be maybe new jobs, even new industries that we haven't conceived of yet.
Yeah, so the difference, I think, between the industries of the future and most books written about the future of technology, I think most books written about the future of technology are either utopian, we're going to live happy, healthy, wealthy lives, everything's going to be great, or it's bedwetting dystopianism. I think the industries of the future, I consider myself sort of a realistic idealist. And to this point, you know, I think that a lot of labor is going to be displaced. But if you actually look back over hundreds of years of American history, of world history, the clear evidence, when you look at it over a long enough trajectory, is that labor does eventually find higher and better forms of activity. So let's talk about farming, for example. In 1870, one out of every two people in the workforce in the United States worked in agriculture. One out of every two. 40 years after that, it was one out of every three. Today, it's one out of every 50. One out of every 50 Americans work in agriculture, but we're producing more food, better food, healthier food than we ever have before. And the worry, and reasonably so, was that with the mechanization of the farm, people said, but wait a second, these are families who have worked on farms for hundreds of years, generations. And it was true, but you know what they are doing? Higher and better forms of labor. You used the word Luddite. The expression, the word Luddite comes from Ned Ludd, who inspired weavers in the early 19th century in North England, when people who were manual weavers saw these automated looms that were going to displace their labor, the Luddites tore down the automated looms because they were like, you know what, we've spent hundreds of years weaving by hand. We can't have looms that do this automatically. So while I'm concerned, and you know, look, the job that my father had, I don't think will exist in 10 or 15 years. That makes me worried, but the sweep of human history suggests to me that there's reason to be at least somewhat optimistic.
Well, unless you're caught in the sweep, unless you're part of the displacement. So I guess my next question is, you know, what is the responsibility of maybe, you know, national governments to ease that transition, to re-educate workers? And do you wait for it to happen, or do you try to get ahead of it?
So first of all, I wish that question were being asked in all the presidential debates. Because, you know, that is such an important question. I think that a lot needs to happen. For example, vocational education, community colleges. Vocational education in community colleges is not necessarily what's discussed at the cool kids table in Silicon Valley, but they're really important. They serve tens of millions of Americans. And they serve segments of our population that are especially vulnerable. So what should governments be doing? In my opinion, governments should be looking at programs like vocational education and community college programs and saying, all right, we know these are vulnerable people. These are not necessarily the people who are going to get the $300,000 a year programming jobs at Facebook. But there is going to be job growth. What interventions can we make to make sure that working class people, middle class people who rely on these kinds of programs, that their skills are being mapped towards where the job openings are? I also think that there's another responsibility, and this is an issue of economic justice. What technology does is it creates more bounty and more spread. By bounty, money is part of bounty, but it also means more and better entertainment choices, information, longer lives. more well-being. We have more stuff because of technology. But it also creates more economic spread. So instead of creating these very large middle classes, you've got billionaires and you've got an increasing number of people who are completely isolated from that. And so if we're simultaneously creating more billionaires and more people who are completely disconnected from that, then I think, from an economic justice standpoint, that we need to strengthen the safety net and we need to raise the safety net. So I think that safety net programs grow ever more important.
Do you feel like any of the presidential candidates are really addressing that? I mean, it seems like some of what you're talking about is an issue that Bernie Sanders has pretty effectively mined.
You know, I think that Bernie Sanders is raising the issue of inequality, but his response is just redistribution and punishing the 1%. And I'm not making judgments positive or negative about that. But what I hear a lot is blame from various of the presidential candidates as opposed to solutions. Now, I have heard some of them, Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio, for example, the two of them have both put forward positions on this stuff. But then, you know, because it's sort of geeky stuff, it ends up on, you know, page B12 for for one day. And even though I think that these kinds of issues will have to do more with the prosperity and the well-being of working and middle-class Americans, you know, if it isn't tweet-sized and if you aren't calling somebody a name, then it doesn't get much attention or much discussion.
It seemed like at one point the issue of the on-demand economy threatened to become a campaign issue, mm-hmm. The status of workers in the new economy, the drivers for Uber and whatnot. Do you feel like that'll come back, and where do you sit on these companies who tout their job creation economies, and yet it's a different kind of work, right?
Right.
It's not; it doesn't have the benefits traditionally associated with full-time jobs.
So I read a lot about this in the Industries of the Future, and this is another case where I am neither a lover nor a hater. I try to take a very balanced view of this. You know, I think that consumers having more choices, like, you know, different cars or, you know, people being able to use a spare bedroom in their house, which is a latent asset, and being able to use that to supplement their income and help pay their mortgage, I think that's a good thing. I take Uber. I don't rent out extra rooms in Airbnb, but you know what? If I were working class and I had a hard time making the mortgage, I would. So I actually believe that people should have the right to build these businesses, and people should have the right to use those products. But what it does do is it raises important questions, and we have to come up with answers to those questions. So a lot of the protections that typically go to the employer, like workers' comp, or, you know, if you get disabled on the job, if you get sick on the job, what about pensions? So what happens is when labor migrates from being employer-based to being sort of project-based, gig-based, sharing economy-based, is as it goes on long enough, and as people who have these jobs age, the protections that historically would have been provided by an employer, it's going to come back on government. You know, if you get hurt on the job and there's no workers' comp, then, you know, you're going to be dependent on the state, the city, the public health system to provide you goods and services. So I do think it raises important questions. And the questions I think have to be answered with, all right, as the nature of labor changes, what are we going to do about it? What are the necessary pivots so that the burdens aren't just being shifted from the private sector to the public sector?
So you think these companies maybe need to take some more responsibility, maybe it's the creation of a worker status that's in between the 1099 and the W-2?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know. You know, I would love to sit here and say, I've got the answer. But the God's honest truth is that I would love to see, for example, an entirely new insurance category created where, workers' comp, you know, where maybe one of the platform companies, an Uber or an Airbnb, pay into it, but so too does the driver or the renter. You know, there's a way of looking at this with how we share the responsibility. We need to set norms. we need to set rules. And it's not about punishing the companies or about punishing the independent contractors. It's about, all right, what is a fair system that just that doesn't just burden shift everything onto government? And this and these are the kinds of things, it's nuanced. Again, you know, there are commas and semicolons involved when you get into the policy making around things like this, but we need to get into it.
So pivoting slightly, in the book, one of the darker predictions is around the inevitability of cyber warfare. And you predict that before too long, you think we will see a financial calamity of some sort, like a sudden decrease in the stock market because of a cyber attack. Now, I guess my question is, why hasn't this happened already? I mean, certainly we've had cyber attacks. You know, plenty of companies have been hit, nothing on the level you're predicting, and we've been living in a network world for, you know, at least a decade. So what's going to change?
So that's a great question. First, let me remind everybody, this is a mostly optimistic book. This is the chapter that's less optimistic. I think the weaponization of code is the most significant development in conflict since the weaponization of fissile material. The difference is that creating a nuclear weapon requires access to the scarcest of scarce scientific talent and transuranium elements, whereas the creation of malware, the barrier to entry, is far lower. And I spent too much time in the White House Situation Room sort of being eyewitness to that which we averted to take a sunshiny view on this topic. But to your question of why has this not already happened before? It goes to incentives. So right now, the countries with the most powerful cyber offensive capabilities are the United States, the UK, Israel, China, a few others. To this point, those countries don't have the incentive to take down our financial systems or for the lights to go off in the subway or something like this. If NASDAQ goes down 1,000 points and it's because of a cyber attack from the Chinese lose because they are now a part of the interconnected global economy. You know, there are plenty of Chinese businessmen who've got money in NASDAQ stocks. So the Chinese to this point have determined that they have an incentive to steal our intellectual property. They steal about $300 billion worth of intellectual property each year, which I do consider to be an enormous steal. We declassified a national intelligence estimate when I was in government, which put that number on it. But they don't have an incentive to take down systems. Part of where I'm dark on this, though, it has to go with Russia. So Russia does not have the capabilities that China does in this domain, but they aren't too far behind. And Putin has let the dogs off the leash. So when we, the Europeans and others, put sanctions on Russia, and when Russia, because of its incursions into Ukraine, basically isolated itself from sort of our interconnected global economy, they suddenly became less of an equity holder in sort of the general well-being. And so the cyber attacks that went into American banks in the summer of 2014, which could have been enormously significant, but ended up not being because of good defenses, I think that the Russians, who at this point want nothing more than to see the United States founder, if their hackers continue to grow in capability, then I could see them engage in some very malignant cyber attacks that do take grids offline or something like that.
What would you like to see to avert this? Is it government getting in, taking a more active role at raising the overall level of defense, or more awareness on the part of financial service companies?
You know, I think that, interestingly enough, I think that they're actually doing the right thing. You know, I think that the Obama administration was initially very slow on cybersecurity. I think in 2009 and 2010, there was a mistake made thinking that we could sort of charm the Chinese. And also at that time, we were issuing such mountains of debt, you know, through the stimulus programs that we needed them to buy our debt. We needed them to buy our treasuries. So we weren't willing to sort of throw an elbow into them for cyber attacks. I think in retrospect, that was a mistake. I think we should have been stronger with the Chinese from the outset. But I think that beginning in about 2011, there was a recognition that this was a tier one foreign policy issue. I think the Obama administration has been incredibly strong since on the issue. I think the banks and the financial service sector gets it. And so I think that the fact that there is a recognition of the problem and that there have been billions of dollars of investment to mitigate it is good. It's not good enough to keep a malignant cyber attack from happening, but I don't think that there's a lack of awareness. What I will say is that in the same way in which you would sort of ding any Fortune 500 company for not having somebody on their board of directors who has an expertise in audit. Like if you look at the board of directors of a Fortune 500 company and there's not an accountant or a past CFO on it, it's a failure in governance. I do think that every Fortune 500 company now does need somebody on their board who understands cybersecurity. So that's where I think the industry needs to go.
So we are all fortunate here to live in the golden confines of Silicon Valley. And it's been remarkable to me living here for the past 20 years of how many technology cycles Silicon Valley has led. So I guess I wonder, in your mostly optimistic, somewhat dark in parts, mm-hmm. vision of the future, does Silicon Valley still lead? And what do other countries need to do to kind of carve off a piece of this?
So I do think that Silicon Valley has another good 20 years in front of it. But what I think is that its relative dominance will decrease. But I think that's a good thing. When you read the industries of the future, part of what the story is, all right, well, these are the 10 to 15 places around the rest of the world that will help build the industries of the future. And why I think this is good and why I think this is good even for Silicon Valley is the greater the geographic spread of the well-being, if nothing else, there's more people to sell stuff to. And I do think that there is virtue and value in not all of the world's wealth and power being concentrated in one place. I also think it really squeezes the middle class when you are living somewhere where there are juxtaposed with such enormous wealth. I mean, try renting an apartment in San Francisco right now. And, just the costs are unreal. But what I do believe is that I think that Silicon Valley is a special place. I think that it will continue to be a special place for, 15 different reasons that enable innovation, that enable entrepreneurship. But a lot of the rest of the world has learned from Silicon Valley and have a number of attributes. And I think that of these 10 to 15 sort of global foci for innovation and entrepreneurship, maybe three or four of them will be in the United States, but then the rest will be around the rest of the world, and not just Europe, but in Asia. And I'm hoping for one in Africa and maybe one or two in South America. And I think this is entirely for the good.
You make the point in the book that one of the factors in the advancement of these other regions is civil rights and the equitable treatment and opportunities for women. Mm-hmm. In this business community, there's been an ongoing debate about opportunities for women at big tech companies, mm-hmm. And in venture capital firms. Talk a little bit about that. Why you think that's relevant,
right,
to this vision of the future, and then maybe in particular how Silicon Valley is doing and what work still needs to be done.
So my assistant did me the terrible disservice of totaling up my travel in recent years, and apparently I've traveled the equivalent of two round trips to the moon with a side trip to New Zealand. And it's really made me a feminist, because what I've seen is that those states and societies that do the most to systematically advantage women's roles in the workplace, in the workplace and in the economy, are those that are best suited to building the industries of the future. And those that have the most regressive views of and policies for women in the workplace are those that I think are, they better keep pumping oil, and they better hope the price of oil goes up, because it's not going to be a good future for them. And there was a really important study that came out 2 days ago that I think validated a lot of the research from the industries of the future. A right of center think tank, the Peterson Economic Institute, came out with a study of 22,000 businesses that showed causality, more than just a correlation, between the number of women in executive ranks in a company and profitability, which I found very affirming. How is Silicon Valley doing on this? Not well enough. And I think that while there are rock star women in Silicon Valley who get a lot of attention, and justifiably so, and a lot of focus is given on how many female CEOs are there and all this stuff, What I think the concentration needs to increasingly be on is how do we get more women into the manager and director ranks? You know, how do we build the total number of women who are in these workplaces? And it's a problem that starts early. You know, we know that girls increasingly become disaffected and disconnected from the sciences and mathematics at a younger and younger age, 11, 12, 13 years old. My wife is a math teacher. We have an 11-year-old daughter. And, you know, this is something she and I have really chosen to immerse ourselves in. And so we've got to begin fixing the problem of the lack of women in the sciences and technology from a young age. But then we do have to deal with workplace cultures that have a baked-in set of assumptions about what traits women have and what traits men have. Like, oh, she's female, so she's a marketer. He's a guy, so he's a sales guy. You know, we've got to really begin to break down the stereotypes we have around this. And Silicon Valley's got plenty of work to do on this.
Before I get to your questions, you know, we have an opportunity to talk to Alec in the middle of a presidential primary campaign. Alec worked with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and it's a little bit of a challenging time for her campaign right now in the wake of her loss in the New Hampshire primary. So I'm just wondering, if you were still working with Secretary Clinton, how would you advise her right now? What would you want to see her say to perhaps reconnect with her base?
Well, what I would say is, and you know, I don't want to be a partisan political person, in part because I want everybody to buy my book, regardless of who you're supporting for president. What I would say is, be yourself, you know, be your most authentic self. You know, people will support you or not support you, but they may as well choose to support you or not support you based on being exactly who you are without an ounce of artifice or spin or anything else. I mean, that's not to suggest that the way she's campaigning now is with artifice or spin or this or that, but if she sort of walked by and we had 30 seconds, what I would say is, be your full self.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Alex Ross. He's a distinguished visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University, and he's in conversation with Brad Stone, a senior writer at Bloomberg Business Week. This event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit membership organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
We've been collecting some of your questions, and I'd like to bring them into our conversation now. If I don't get to them all, we'll have time following the radio broadcast recording to open the floor up for more questions and comments. So a lot of these questions have to do with your vision of robotics, and I love them because there's a slight kind of science fiction flavor to them all. So let's start with this one. What will we do with our free time created by robotics taking over the workplace? Will humans still work? Do we need to?
So that is such a great question. And you referenced Silicon Valley venture capitalist Marc Andreessen earlier. And he postulates that robotics will grow so sophisticated that we're going to have a lot more recreational time and we'll be able to reengage in literature and the arts and such things. I hope he's right. It seems a little utopian to me. I work really hard, and I'm just trying to imagine an 8-hour workday. So if the robots can take some of that out, that's great. What I do think is that I'm going to go actually to a dark side on this. What I do worry about is youth unemployment. What I worry about are 18 to 29-year-olds who have a very difficult time finding jobs. Like for me, you know, in my 40s, I've been successful to this point, so I would love to be displaced a little bit. But that's look, youth unemployment is a huge problem.
It's a recipe for political unrest.
It is. You do not want a 18 to 29-year-old unemployed or underemployed males. We've got thousands of years of revolutions, you know, that they've fueled and all kinds of mayhem. So I actually worry about the free time more than I embrace the free time, because the people who I end up, I have a feeling, having the free time are not going to be guys like me. It's going to be that 21-year-old, 22-year-old who can't get that starter job or who doesn't want to work at Chipotle because they've got a college degree and they feel like they should be doing something else. So I actually think it could be highly problematic.
A related question. please comment on the risks of centralized control of three CPUs. Will we be dealing with robot drones? Mm. Of course, we already are.
Right. So this, I actually think this is a reasonable question about, let's call it autonomy in artificial intelligence. So when I was in government, there was one of the things that was debated was the degree to which there should be autonomy in drones. Like, should drones be able to make up their own mind about what they do? And the decision was made, rightly, that no, you can never remove humans from key decisions being made, for example, by drones. And so the idea of sort of central control of artificial intelligence, I think that we can't entirely give ourselves up to algorithms. There's this false notion that algorithms were somehow created by divine beings, when in fact, algorithms were programmed by humans. And algorithms have these things that nobody... algorithms produce these things called error bars, which is the probability for failure and error. And so I do think that we cannot turn AI over to what I would call autonomous management. We have to keep humans involved throughout. And to give Silicon Valley a little bit of credit for a moment here, there are some very wealthy local Silicon Valley stakeholders who recently announced a $1 billion commitment to what they're calling OpenAI, which is, you know, AI for good, or making sure that artificial intelligence does develop in a way that is positive and benefiting mankind as opposed to
Terminator. I mean, Well, let's talk about that for a second. Like, the common science fiction depiction is that things do go wrong, even with the best intentions.
It does. And, well, now I'm going to be optimistic. Let's talk about autonomous vehicles. So right now, globally, about 3 million people are killed a year in automobile accidents. And we accept, for lack of a better word, we allow people to drive, even though we know that a significant number of people will die. One of the reasons why I'm actually an advocate for autonomous vehicles is if we can prove that autonomous vehicles kill fewer people than human drivers, then from my standpoint, it would be worth doing. The question, though, is as a society, when will we be ready to accept a human being being killed by a software glitch, as opposed to a human being killed by a driver who fell asleep or who had too many drinks or who didn't see the red light? So this is what's going to be really interesting to me. But in this case, just as a way of sort of switching things up, I actually am in favor of autonomy with human oversight, but I'm ready to get into a car with an electronic driver.
What's your prediction for the time frame on that? I mean, there's remarkable little agreement, even in Silicon Valley, even within a company like Uber, you've got people saying 5 years and then board members saying 20 years.
So I think it is, I'm going to say my two numbers are going to be 7 and 15. And let me explain what I mean by 7 and 15. I think the technology will be there in 7 years. There are very intensive investments being made. The attention around here goes to Uber and Google, but all the big car companies are investing very heavily in this and well. I think the technology will be there in 7 years. I think the bigger barrier to these things taking over the roads is cultural and regulatory. So getting to the point where we want to be driven or where we accept that the car beside us on the highway doesn't have a driver, and then government's regulation of it, autonomous vehicles right now are only legal in 3 states. So I have a feeling that in lots of states it will be illegal. And so I think that it'll be 15 years at a point where the technology has really developed to a point where people are feeling very comfortable about it. And there's a clear demonstration that it'll save lives where it then takes over. And even then, I think it would only be largely in the more urban areas and in the wealthier areas, as opposed to the more rural areas and the less wealthy areas.
My kids are about the same age as yours. Do they get driver's licenses?
Oh, they'll definitely get driver's licenses, yeah.
Will they drive as much as we did?
Well, here's my, so what I imagine is that my kids will drive into their 20s. My question is, at what point do they stop driving?
Another question from the audience. With the rise of new technologies, do you see an increasing gap between the first world countries and developing nations? How would technology affect the global balance of power?
So I see it bringing first world countries and developing countries more closer together. In those, you know, 25 circumferences of the globe that I've taken, a lot of that time is spent in frontier economies, very low-income developing economies. And connectivity, internet access, has taken what were historically very isolated poor communities and have brought it into the mainstream. So one aspect of my book, The Industries of the Future, that's very optimistic is the focus on Africa. And Africa is not all one place. It's 54 different countries. But to speak generally about the continent, I think it's going to be a great next 10 years for Africa. When I got out of college 20 years ago, Africa was a center of conflict and development assistance. When I go to Africa now that it's had a couple years of 3G wireless connectivity, what's great is I see the genius being unleashed there. And, you know, I've always believed that talent is evenly distributed, but opportunity isn't. And now that Africa has been largely connected by 3G connectivity for a number of years, I can see that. When I traveled to Lagos, Nigeria in December, I saw these young Nigerians who were coding and working for companies like Google from Lagos. I'm really optimistic about what technology is doing for frontier economies and developing economies, because what it means is that if you used to live in what was a very isolated poor community, you can now be a part of the global workforce and be paid by companies tens of thousands of miles away while staying there.
Well, this one's in the book, but the idea around designer babies and selecting the height and the eye color of your, and maybe the gender of your next child, maybe it's not a ridiculous idea. It's certainly to a lot of people going to feel like a threatening idea.
It is. So this is a case where I actually do have the scientific basis for it. So I'm at Johns Hopkins University now, which has one of the best medical schools in the world, and I've learned a lot over the last couple of years about what's going to happen with the commercialization of genomics. And I got to tell a little story. I've learned most of it from the guy who I played racquetball with. And at first I thought this guy was just sort of a gym rat, sort of in his 60s, sort of crazy gray hair, big gray beard. He wears a knee brace on the outside of his 1970s style gray sweatpants, brings his racquetball gear to the court in a Samsonite suitcase. Turns out this guy, Bert Vogelstein, is the world's most cited living scientist. It was his team at Johns Hopkins that actually determined decades ago how mutations in proteins cause cancer. Kind of a big deal. And what Vogelstein's team has since done is they have figured out how, in a vial of blood, the likes of which you would give right now at your annual checkup to check your cholesterol, they can detect cancerous cells at 1/100th the size of what can be detected by an MRI, which means that we will be able to routinely identify cancerous cells early in stage 1 that we now identify in stage 3 and stage 4. This is something that is an absolute game changer in terms of increasing life expectancy. Now let's look at the dark side. The dark side of this technology, of being able to get into our genetic material and draw information from it and be able to alter it if we so choose, is some of the doctors on his team explained to me, they said, you know, right now when a woman is pregnant, we can tell her very early in her pregnancy, congratulations, it's a boy. Congratulations, it's a girl. And then over the course of your pregnancy, you'll take a genetic test, which my wife took with each of her three pregnancies. And basically the genetic test tells you the probability that the baby is going to have Down syndrome. And with that information, you can make choices as a parent. In the very near future, when you go to the doctor, if you so choose, based on your genetic material drawn from the womb, they'll be able to say, congratulations, it's a boy. He'll probably be between 5'6" and 5'8". He'll have curly brown hair. There's a 13% chance he'll get Parkinson's. There's an 11% chance he'll be an alcoholic. There's a 9% chance of this, an 8% chance of that. That's crazy. But it is the knowledge that we can draw out, the building blocks of our genetics. And the question then is, I mean, some of the ethical questions are, what if you don't want a 5'6" brown-haired boy who has a 13% chance of getting Parkinson's and an 11% chance of being an alcoholic? Do you decide to bring that child to term or not? Or if CRISPR technology advances, do you say, let's go in, let's try to repair the damaged DNA that is, you know, creating a likelihood for a series of negative outcomes that we don't want to have? And so my belief is that as the science and technology grows more powerful, as we're able to detect cancerous cells at 1/100th the size of what can be detected by an MRI, so too should we make sure that our human values guide us, you know, as the science and the technology grows more powerful.
Here's another question from the audience, and it's a very topical one. Can and how can we use technology to combat ISIS? And I presume that is aside from drones visiting destruction from the sky.
Right. So the reason why Al-Qaeda had to hide in caves and really didn't recruit at great scale, but ISIS holds physical territory and is recruiting hundreds and thousands of young people, has in part to do with technology. So during Al-Qaeda's heyday, they didn't have social media, you know, they had to smuggle cassettes to the Al Jazeera station, right? And so being able to recruit and organize impressionable young Muslims was substantially more difficult. ISIS is sort of a whiz-bang organization in terms of how they use communications tools, social media tools, and other such things. And so I'm not in favor I'm not condemning the platform companies for providing the tools because they're free for everybody to use. But what I do believe is that we now need to use those same, oftentimes American technology platforms to recognize that they're being used to foster radicalization. And we've got to figure out how we can shut a lot of that down, either whether it's through technological means, whether it's through our own counter-narratives. But my attitude is that we should not be outperformed on YouTube and Twitter and all of this by ISIS. And so I want the technology companies and I want all the social media gurus and whomever else to be part of the solution in countering violent extremism.
Well, that's actually a hot button issue. I mean, how much more should the technology companies be doing to aid not only law enforcement, but our efforts to combat terrorism? And then you get into the questions of cryptography,
right?
and should Microsoft and Google and the other companies be creating back doors for law enforcement to go in and find out who's planning attacks?
Yeah. So my view on this is, first of all, it's a bad idea for there to be mandatory back doors into crypto, because in my opinion, that's like leaving a key under the doormat. Like if we create a mandatory back door where we break crypto for the FBI, then what the Chinese are going to do the exact same thing. The Russians are going to do the exact same thing. If you create a single protocol allowing for a backdoor into crypto, we cannot just assume it's going to be an American intelligence service or law enforcement agency that can access it. So we, as much responsibility as I believe our technology companies have to be a part of the solution and to work constructively and productively with our law enforcement and intelligence agencies, what I don't believe, where I draw the line, is saying let's break the technology so that there is real-time frictionless access to cryptographic content that flows through the servers of the NSA in Fort Meade and flows through the servers of all of the domestic law enforcement agencies. This is a case where, again, you know, I think responsible policy involves a few commas and a few semicolons, you know.
Here's a great question that we're probably actually late to address in this conversation. What do you think is the future of privacy, given growing public and private sector capacities for surveillance, data mining, and hacking?
Yeah, so I think norms around privacy are going to shift. I think everybody's going to have a scandal. I think that the transparency in the world is going to shift human norms. Like JFK was able to be elected president in 1960 despite all of personal behavior that would have been scandalous if it had come to light. In a world of video-enabled mobile phones and Twitter and Facebook and this and that, the behavior of John F. Kennedy in the 1950s wouldn't have been private and secret. But what I believe is going to shift is that I think that there's going to be so much more transparency that I think we are going to increasingly accept human fallibility. So I think let's talk about marijuana and presidential candidates for a second. In the 1992 presidential candidate, it was like a big question, you know, when Bill Clinton said, "I didn't inhale," you know. It's like, oh, you know, if he inhaled that joint, you know, that really calls into question whether he should be president or not. 16 years later, Barack Obama's like, oh, I inhaled. I inhaled a lot. No, by the way, I also snorted coke. Non-issue. What shifted? Norms shifted. So what I believe is that in a world with less privacy and with more transparency, norms will shift. And I think that is mostly good. I do fret about the loss of privacy. Look, thank goodness there wasn't Facebook when I was in college. I had a lot of fun in college. And I'm glad that there isn't a lot of digital evidence of it. My kids, when they go to college, there will be Facebook. They will leave digital fingerprints and footprints everywhere. And so while I think it's good that norms shift, that we increasingly understand that all humans are fallible, and that none of us are perfect, and what have you, I do think that there are parts of our lives that should remain private, and that I believe will be more difficult to keep private in a world of 40 billion networked devices around us.
This is a great question relating to your work in the Congo. How does digital technology degrade traditional culture? Are there any downsides to bringing digital technology to third world communities?
You know, I haven't seen it. Like in the Congo, for example, the impact I saw of technology being introduced there and the programs that I was involved in is it decreased corruption, for example. So instead of a general and his colonels taking, you know, suitcases full of banknotes that were supposed to be used to pay the soldiers were paid over their mobile phones. I did work in the refugee camps in the Congo, and as poor as these refugee camps were, there was a 14%, and this is a while ago, so I'm sure it's much higher now, but 14% of the people in the refugee camps had cell phones, and there were basically three users per cell phone, so a de facto 42% penetration of cell phones into refugee camps. And if you ask yourself, well, why do you need a cell phone if you're in a refugee camp? Well, think about those movies from the 1990s where families are separated and it takes them months or years to find each other. With cell phones, they could find each other. So the process of displacement from conflict, which we know from all the literature, oftentimes would disconnect families for months and years. Increasingly now, it's about hours, days, or weeks. So what I've seen of the impact of technology being brought into, you know, historically very poor developing countries just makes me more optimistic about it.
Let me ask a related question, because there's a little bit of a debate right now around Silicon Valley companies bringing internet into developing nations, but doing so with conditions. So in India, Facebook is offering a service called Free Basics, and there's a real debate there as to whether, you know, even though we can agree that having the internet in some of these communities is good, doing it on Facebook's terms with a limited amount of services that really center around Facebook itself is maybe a little bit of a compromise. So in these developing nations that maybe don't have access to technology, but they might be able to get it from the drones beaming down internet access from Google or Facebook, is that a compromise that they should make?
So I spent 8 years of my life working on digital divide issues, you know, helping to bring broadband into poor communities. And I understand, so there are a little bit more than 3 billion people on the planet right now who are internet users. I understand how market forces will get us to the 4th billion. I understand how market forces will get us to the 5th billion. I don't understand how pure market forces will get us to the last 2 billion. And so what I don't want is a world of 5 billion haves and 2 billion servant class have-nots. And so when the Facebooks and the Googles try to serve that last 2 billion, I'm all for it. Because it's, you know, Vodafone and AT&T and Verizon aren't building networks into these communities. And so if Facebook and Google want to try some crazy things, I'm all for it. And the evidence is that once people are connected, what they want is more connectivity. They want more choice. So what my hope is that if you introduce these tool, if you introduce connectivity into these communities, then they, like all of the rest of us, will want more and more, better, better, faster, faster. Now, having said that, I am a proponent of net neutrality. So what I hope is that these programs, whomever is bringing the connectivity into the communities, can do their very best to try and respect the principle of net neutrality.
So in our time remaining, I think we have to come back to the campaign of your former boss. So here's a question about Hillary Clinton's campaign. If Hillary is elected as president, what do you think she will emphasize or do on cyber diplomacy?
On cyber diplomacy, let me answer that two ways. So if that means cybersecurity, then I think she's going to be really tough. I know Vladimir Putin is hoping for anybody but Hillary Clinton to be elected president, because I think he knows she is the one person who can bring it to him. And I think he knows that she will not be rolled. I think she will be pretty tough on the Chinese, because I think that she is not naive about how to engage with them. I mean, she's a tough woman. And so I think that if we're talking about cybersecurity diplomacy, then I think that you can expect her to not be bellicose, but to not be weak.
How about Donald Trump? Do you think he has a grasp for some of these topics?
No, I don't think he has a grasp of anything. I think he's a fascist. And I don't mean that as an adjective, I mean that as a noun. I was a student of political and economic European history. I think that his views map more to Benito Mussolini than Ronald Reagan. I think he's a horrible human being.
Well, on that somewhat inflammatory note, I would like to say goodnight to our radio listeners and thank Alec Ross for this excellent discussion.
Thank you. You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured Alec Ross. He's Distinguished Visiting Fellow at Johns Hopkins University, and he is in conversation with Brad Stone, senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode or register for upcoming events or to join the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producers Circle. Our recording engineer is Rob Spate. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.